Thank you very much. The title of this lecture is something to the effect of, How Can Judaism Make You More Spiritual? I suppose in order to really talk about this, we have to define what spiritual means. I have a friend who has studied together with me in yeshiva. He probably won't admit it, but he did. And one of the things, amongst other things, he teaches Judaism to people in Hollywood. Obviously, he doesn't do this full time because he'd like to retain his sanity. And so he told me that he met once with Goldie Hawn, who was Jewish, and as it's explicit in the Hanukkah song, as you know. And so he meets with Goldie Hawn and to teach her Jewish mysticism, spirituality, Kabbalah, etc. And she has a room in her house, which is a meditation room, which is done in pink lavender wallpaper, and there's aromatherapy candles, you know, all over the place, and there is sitar music, Ravi Shankar in Central Park, you know, that type of stuff, and they're sitting on cushions, and she looks at him and she says, Rabbi, is this spiritual enough? And he thought to himself, what is her understanding of spiritual? It's relaxing. Relaxing. That's what a lot of people believe spirituality is. You go to a concert, you hear a great concert, and it was wonderful, the music was wonderful, people come out and say, oh, that was so spiritual. What they really mean is, it was relaxing. You see, spirituality, from the Jewish point of view, and it's interesting to note, my CD-ROM tells me that no one is actually described as spiritual in the Torah. You don't have a description of Ruchani. Right? Ruchani. You have descriptions of people, for instance, actually my CD-ROM says, there are 110 occurrences of the word tzaddik. And tzaddik means righteous. There are people who are described as chassid, pious. If you look altogether in the Tanakh, Torah, Prophets and Writings, the Talmud and the Midrashim, there are something like 1,500 occurrences of people being described as a tzaddik. There are one or two of people being described as godly or spiritual. Very interesting, I think. Because the Jewish concept of a tzaddik is something much, much more than describing someone as spiritual. In the Western sense and the world as a whole, people are indeed searching. There's a tremendous amount, hence the popularity of people who are searching for spiritual. I mean, you have but you have celebrities who are indeed enrolling in courses in Kabbalah, and there is a tremendous upheaval and a search for something like this, because people recognize that there is something more to life than physical. I think the first definition of spirituality, from the Jewish point of view at least, is there is more to life and there is more to the human than what meets the eye. We see, what we see on the surface of the human being is chomer, substance, matter. That's what we see. We see the material person, or the material girl in the case of Madonna. Right? We see the material, we see matter. That's what's obvious to us, that's what's blatant. That's all we see. And because of that, there are many, many people who would, and the more, by the way, one's focus is on the material, the more difficult it is to feel that there's more than that. In other words, if my identification as a human being is totally in the physical level, that's how I identify myself, you ask me, who are you? And I say, this is me. Of course, pointing to the center of the chest, which is not me. I should really point to there, right? The frontal lobe, that's more me. And even that is not really me, because me is much more spiritual now. It's not really pertaining to the material, to the physical. The human being is much greater than the mere physical. It's interesting, the term for human in Hebrew, the original human is Adam. Adam. Everyone's heard of that term? Adam. The word Adam is from Adama. There's two meanings to that, the Maharal points out. In the Torah itself, in the Bible itself, the term Adama means earth. Because we were created from the earth. But it also has another way, you can read another way. As you all know, Hebrew and Hawaiian are total opposites. Right? That needs no explanation. Right? Okay, I'll explain anyway. If that's for me, I'll call them back. Anyway, so in Hawaiian, it's almost all vowels, you know, like that type of thing, right? Hebrew is almost all consonants, right? Now, where do you get the vowel sounds in Hebrew? You have to have the dots and dashes underneath and in the middle. The dots and dashes were created in Tiberius much, much after the Torah was actually written. So actually, the Torah itself has the ability to be read in different ways, and there are different levels of meaning within that depending on how you read a word. There are many, many examples of that. Just for a chalev means fat, chalav means milk. They're written the same way. So, aim means mother, im means if, written the same way. So, another word, adama means earth, but it also, with different vowel soundings, spells the word edameh. What does edameh mean? Edameh, any Hebraists here? No. What does edameh mean? I will resemble. I will become similar to. And the concept here is that within the human being, there is both adama, earth, and there is also the, I will become similar to God. Only the human being has the unique ability to either be earth, dirt, or to be similar to God, to be God-like. As the verse says in Psalms, Vatachasrehu me'at me'elokim, and he is just made a little bit less than God. Some translate that as a little bit less than the angels, but some translate that as a little bit less than God. So that's the greatness of the human being, as Solomon ibn Gvirol, the Hebrew poet, put it, Regel achat b'shol tachtit, regel achat b'rekiah shvi'it. Which means, the English doesn't do it justice, but one foot in the depths of hell, one foot in the seventh heaven. Right, that's the human being. Human being could be the suicide bomber who without the slightest pangs of conscience is prepared to kill thousands of people so he can go to the great brothel in the sky. And the other extreme is, basically, the other extreme is the human being for like that one person, and I'm sure there are thousands of cases. There was one Jew, an Orthodox Jew, who was in the World Trade Center, who stayed with his paralyzed co-worker to provide her comfort in the last moments, not to leave her there to die by herself. And he died with her. That's the human being. The extremes of the human being are incredible. That extreme which the human being is capable of is because the human being has got both the physical, both the spiritual. So to look at the human being only in terms of the physical, to look at the human being in the sense of a B.F. Skinner, like the behavioral psychologist looks at the human being as basically this conditioned, the rat running the Skinner maze. You know, you press one lever, you get the pellets, you press the other lever, you get electric shock. That's it. That's totally, totally missing the boat. The human can only be viewed if we view the human in that which cannot be seen. The other element to the human being, that which is unseen, the spiritual, the soul, the neshama, that's really the essence of the human being. The body, important as it is, the body is the interface between the spiritual, the soul, and the physical world. Just like, for instance, your computer communicates in binary, 10010, etc., and your phone line communicates in analog. So the computer's going on, off, on, off, on, off, and the phone line's going... And what do you need? You need an interface. So the interface, the modem, whatever equipment you have that does the interface, that's really what the body is. Because the body and the soul, the physical and the spiritual, communicate in different... They're in different wavelengths. The beauty of the human being, and this we say in the blessing that we recite in praising God for the greatness of the human being, Rofe kol basar, healer of all flesh, umafli la'asot, who does wonders. What's the wonder in the human being? If you look in the Code of Jewish Law, where it discusses this particular blessing, it says the wonder of the human being is that God placed the physical and the spiritual in this one being. Those two extremes. In the animal, the Hebrew word for animal, by the way, behemah, is composed of two Hebrew words, the Maharal points out, ba, ma, which means, in it is what there is. In it, ba, in it, ma, is what there is. You will never find a cow that will say, I've got to go on a diet. Look at me. It's not going to happen. You'll not find a pit bull who will go to a sensitivity training course. All right, the ability to change, to go from one extreme to the other, is exclusively human. Behema, ba, ma. In it, what it is, the human being is Adameh, could be similar to God. So when we first talk about spirituality requires an awareness of the greatness, of the splendor, of the ability and the power of the human being. Without an appreciation of that, a person whose view is totally materialistic, this is what the human being is, just a bunch of, electrical firing of circuits and the neurons crossing the synapses, and that's the end of the story. It's a bunch of chemicals, etc. That's not humans. That's not a human being. Not a human being. The human is that ability. And by the way, a human who does not contain within him or her the ability to be the greatest and on the level of an angel and the ability to be the lowest depth is not human. We've got both within us. We've got both within us. And so, in our first aspect of this concept is that spirituality is a recognition that what a human really is, which is far more than the physical. I just got back from Israel. Did a tour in Israel for a week, just was wonderful. I hadn't been back for 2 years. Lived there for 18 years, and I led a tour there just last week. So we met a number of authentic heroes. One of them was a man by the name of Effie Etam. Effie Etam, for those who do not know him, he's the Minister of Infrastructure of Israel. He also is a retired general who was commander of Israeli Special Forces. He was a commando yami, a naval commando, which is the Israeli equivalent of SEALs. The American SEALs, of course, much, much better, obviously. Right? And makes the SEALs look like arf compared to... Anyway, but basically, he was the commander. So he was on Entebbe. He was at Entebbe. And he's a man who is... my hand is still actually a little hurting from the handshake that he gave me last week. Right? But one of the things he said was, interesting, he was talking about, he is a religious Jew. He did not start out as a religious Jew. He started out in a secular, socialist, atheistic kibbutz known as Ein Gev. That's how he was brought up. And at approximately age 27... he started getting into Judaism. He eventually went to a yeshiva called Merkaz Harav, and he got smicha, rabbinic ordination, from there, and he now is a minister in the government. Many people say he'll be the next prime minister. I say halavai, right? But anyway, one of the things he said was, what brought him to search for Judaism? What brought him into his search for spirituality? One of the things he said was he had reached the height of as far as you could get in terms of the physical. He was ultimate athlete, right? He had a degree in mathematics and international science, right? International politics or international relations, something like that, right? And, you know, in physically speaking, he'd reached the height. And he said, okay, now what? Now what? And very often you find that those who are searching for spirituality are not those who are the down and outs, the little engine that could not, right? Rather... right, they are people, right, they are people who, on the contrary, have reached great heights in the physical world. Great heights in the physical world. And now they see, but what else is there? What else is there? So that's the first component of Judaism in terms of spirituality. And Judaism has many, many techniques and mechanisms to make us aware that the human is not just physical. The human is spiritual. Many techniques. I'm not going to go into all of them. I'll give you one example. We have a law in Judaism called Tum'ah. Tum'ah means impurity. Impurity. What creates Tum'ah? Impurity. For example, anything related to death creates impurity. So, for example, a dead body, according to Jewish tradition, according to Jewish law, if a person touches or is under the same roof as a dead body, they become tamei, impure. What does that mean? What does that mean? Another example of impurity would be you wake up in the morning, if you've been sleeping, you wake up, you have to wash your hands in a very special way because you are impure. What's the idea? So the concept Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch says is the following. The word tumah in Hebrew is related to the word timtum, which means confusion. Confusion. If you're in Israel and someone calls you Amerikai matumtum, that means a confused American. It's not a polite thing, right? It's like matumtum, right? And timtum is confusion, sealed up. The idea is the following, Rehersh says. The human really is eternal. The human being is really spiritual. But the experience of death is so overwhelming that you see what was once human reduced to merely a material corpse. It's it. Isn't that a tremendous, tremendously overwhelming illusion that that's all there is to the human being, right? Anyone who's ever experienced that will say, this is it, this is the human being. Where's the soul? Where's the life? Where is everything? All you see is flesh and blood. That's it. Tremendously major illusion, and it creates confusion spiritually. It's the ultimate illusion, because really we know the soul is eternal. The soul exists. The soul will exist forever. But the death creates that illusion that, there's nothing more. There's nothing more than the physical. And that illusion creates what we call tumah. And therefore, Judaism has all these techniques for getting out of that, for getting back into life. Why is sleep an example of that? The Talmud says sleep is 1/60th of death. I had roommates who I would say it's about 2/3. But nevertheless, right, getting them up in the morning was literally a resurrection. It was unbelievable. It really gave you renewed faith. Yeah. So the idea is that when one is asleep, one's actions are controlled not by your eternal soul, by free will, by the spiritual. How are they controlled? Instinct. My arm moves around at night. It's not because I willed it to do so. I made a decision. This is how I'm going to move my arm. Rather, it's because, I have these spasms every now and then. Whatever. I move around. It's not my conscious control. And consequently, since here again there's the illusion that the spiritual is controlled by the physical, so we have to in some way counteract that. We wash our hands as a way of saying my actions in my waking hours, those actions will be controlled by what? Thought. Not instinct, but thought. Right? Not by the physical, but by the spiritual. Not by autopilot, but by free will. And that's a way of Judaism doing that. So we have many, many components of Judaism are designed to, for example, when we eat, we say a blessing. Say a blessing before we eat. What's the reason for that? There are many reasons given. The Talmud, of course, says it's that you have to ask permission. The world is God's and everything in it, right? But there's another aspect to it as well, which is the recognition that my eating should not merely... I'm not an animal. It's not Mordechai going to the trough, right? Or putting on the feed bag, right? Well, those who've seen me eat may have that illusion, but it's not, right? It's really all controlled. Everything is understood, right? But it is the idea that I am recognizing that, hello, there's more to me than what I'm eating. You are what you eat, but you're a lot more than what you eat. The blessing is a way of saying that. It's a way of saying, hold on. You're a person. You're human. Right? So many, many aspects of Judaism are designed to give me an awareness that there's more to me, there's more to the human, there's more to us than what meets the eye. Much more than what meets the eye. Very, very basic first lesson in Judaism about being spiritual is that awareness of there's more to it. The second aspect of spirituality in Judaism is to be aware of God, to be aware that there is a God. I don't put this second because I just put this second because I think in definition of spirituality, the first thing that hits us is ourselves more than God. All right, although more central is God is more central than that. But nevertheless, I'm putting the second just because in terms of our awareness, first thing that hits us is who am I, what am I, and the awareness of myself. And that, by the way, part of that comes with maturity, part of that comes, and obviously a person who's totally involved in the pursuit of the physical can't even see that anymore. Sometimes people can be blinded to the spiritual components of the self. They can be blinded just by everything physical. There's a guy in New York during the dot-com craze, when people were becoming rich overnight and they had to go to support groups for people who became rich too quickly. Hallelujah for all of us. We should go to therapy for that. Anyway, so that's what I got. So there's a guy, he's on Madison Avenue, and he's triple parked. And he says, hey, why not? I mean, .com, man, I shouldn't triple park anywhere. So, right, so he triple parks on Madison Avenue, and he opens the door of his new Porsche. And a taxi comes by and slams into the door, injuring his hand terribly. Mangling his arm, the door is like smashed to smithereens, the mirror, the whole works. He's standing there in a daze, in a state of shock. He's saying, my Porsche, blood's dripping, my Porsche. An EMT comes over to him and says, sir, your arm. He looks at his arm and says, my Rolex. People are so embedded in the physical, they cannot see anything else. They can't see beyond that. They can't see beyond that. Judaism is telling us, look beyond that. Look beyond that. When you judge another person, when you look at another person, just another technique. In Judaism, the laws of modesty, the way we dress also is a means of having us focus on what's the essence of the human being. Sometimes you can be so blinded by the physical of the human being that you can't see the physical, you can't see the spiritual. You know what I mean? Everything else stands out in such bright and technicolor 3D that you can't see the soul. Right. This is right. It's especially true in male-female relationships. Right. People can't. Right. You know, it's just impossible. People cannot see. Right. Guys in locker rooms never say, "Didn't that cheerleader have such a wonderful soul? I mean, the personality that just shone from her, what a smile. Never, right? There maybe have people who have not been in locker rooms here, I'm telling you, right? No one ever talks about that, right? It's never the soul, right? Why? You're so blinded by everything else. You can't see the soul. So that's the first component, spirituality. The second is awareness of God. Awareness of the presence of God in the world. To be aware that there is a God. Here, the more successful a person is, very often the greater the difficulty is to see that. A person who's very successful tends to sometimes have the feeling, Kochi v'otsem yadi, asalia tachai lazeh, as it says in Deuteronomy, that when the Jewish people, God says, when the Jews go to the land of Israel and will become successful, he says one of the things they'll say is, ah, look how great we are. And sometimes success carries with it also a danger. And the danger is forgetting about the existence of God. It's interesting to note, the Torah itself obligates us to say only, really, a blessing over food. There's only one blessing over food in which there's a biblical obligation to say. Anyone know what that is? Benching. Correct. Birkat HaMazon, the grace after meals. That's biblically, you have to say that. Ve'achalta ve'savata uverachta et Hashem Elokecha. You shall eat and be satiated and thank the Lord your God. Now, it's interesting, we do say blessings before we eat. But the blessings before we eat are of rabbinic origin. The rabbis legislated them in approximately 400 or so BCE, men of the Great Assembly. Why is it, you could ask a question, why is it the Torah, Bible, only obligated us to say blessings after we eat and not a blessing before we eat? Anyone ever bothered? I don't know. No, it bothered me. But I saw the answer in the Meshech Chochmah, Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, and he says the following. He says, the Torah says, where is there the greatest danger of the person forgetting God? When they've just had a great meal, I was just at the best restaurant I've ever been to in my entire life, is on 30 Sderot Yerushalayim in Jaffa. 30 Jerusalem Boulevard, it's called Alhambra. I highly recommend anyone who wants the phone number, come to me afterwards. Right, I don't get paid by them, it's unbelievable. I was with a guy who's eaten at Ruth Chris Steakhouse regularly, right, who goes to all the places, and he said, this is the best he's ever been to, right? Gluck kosher, wonderful, right? So you're sitting there, just had this unbelievable meal, right? I had a nice drambuie afterwards, right? We had some great Golan wines, best wine in the world from the Golan Heights, right? And I do like Israel a little bit. But I'm sitting there, right? When's there the greatest likelihood of a person saying, forget about God? That's where it is. So there God says, hey, hello, bench. Right? Now say a blessing. Now acknowledge this from God. When I'm hungry, before I've eaten, less likelihood. So therefore, the obligation to say a blessing before you eat, it's a rabbinic obligation. It's still an obligation, but it's rabbinic. Obligation after you eat, that's already a biblical obligation, explicit in the Bible. Why? Because that's when there is a great danger. The Yishman Yeshurim V'Yivah, in contemporary history, it's interesting to point out, and also Ephiad Tam pointed this out, that in Israel, more people, more secular Jews, if there is such a thing, I don't think there is such a thing, but anyway, let's say, right, a secular Jew, because as, there's really inside every secular Jew, there is a religious Jew just crying to get out, right? Now. So, but anyway, the amongst secular Jews, a return to Judaism, where was there a greater amount of people returning to Judaism, after the 67 war or after the 73 war? Because after the Six-Day War, tremendous lightning victory. We captured an area three times what we had. Unbelievable. Right? And the 73 war came that close to defeat. When did more people turn to God? Interesting to note, after the 73 war, not after the 67. Why? Because in 67, there was the feeling, I'm the greatest. We are the greatest. We're the best at everything. After the 73 war, people began to realize, maybe we're getting some help. Maybe we're getting some help. I met another person whose belief in God also perhaps came from a different point of view. F.E.A. Tam, his journey to God and to religion, right, was really through seeing that he reached the heights. There's another person I met who reached the depths, and that's where his contact with God came, which is this idea. His name, Binyamin Kiryati, he's the mayor of Tiberia. Anyone heard of him? He was one of the top Israeli air aces, top Israeli pilots. And just after the 73 war, he was testing a new technique in attacking a SAM missile battery. This is the surface-to-air missiles that the Syrians were very effectively used in the 73 war. He had a new tactic. He volunteered for this. He was commander of a top squadron in the Israeli Air Force. He volunteered to go by himself to test this tactic. Turns out that the Syrians somehow knew he was coming, and it was an ambush. They fired 82 missiles at his plane. 82 missiles at his plane. One hit. One hit. And that damaged the plane, caused him serious injury, killed his co-pilot. He was flying very low, and he headed towards Lebanon. He figured he'd have a greater chance of survival if he was in Lebanon than Syria. But he was very low, and he saw the plane was not responding at all, and he was heading towards mountains that separate Syria and Lebanon. So he decided to eject. So he survived 82 missiles and massive injuries. He ejects. His ejection, they calculated the radar followed him, calculating the vectors and trajectory. He is the fastest ever ejection speed to have survived. I think the number, I don't remember the number, it was something like in the 400-500 miles per hour, his seat. No one survives that. He survived. He lands in Syria. The Syrians immediately sees a helicopter looking for him. And the Syrian soldier sees him moving in the rocks, fires at full automatic. Hits him in both arms and both legs. Nothing internal is hurt. And he survives. Taken to a helicopter. Syrians take him and they torture him for 38 days. Continuously. For the new Israeli tactics. He survived. He was eventually exchanged in a prisoner of war exchange and came back to Israel. In hospital for more than a year, during which time he got a law degree. Became a professor at Tel Aviv University. Opened a law practice. Became very famous bankruptcy lawyer in Israel, and eventually retired and became mayor of Tiberias, where his family lived for 10 generations. Is this amazing? And he said in that total depth, that's where he found God. That's where he found God. You can find, so spirituality, meaning awareness of God, awareness of self can come, of what the real self is can come, even when one is totally successful. Because you say, what's next? And you see the spirituality next. He also saw that he found God in seeing that it, because until that time he said he felt he was at the top. I mean, pilots in Israeli society are the elite. They're at the top. They get all the women. They get all the good jobs. They get all the prestige. They're the top. That's what he felt. He was at the In the Syrian prison, he was at the bottom. He saw it's not kochi v'otzim yadi, it's not my power and the strength of my hand anymore, but there's a God here. And he's a traditional man. Traditional man. Believer in God. Interesting. So we have, therefore, one technique of Judaism is to make us aware that even in the times of our success, to be aware that there is a God. Awareness of God. That what we have, what we do, our success, and everything, we have to say, thank God. Thank God. Even if I'm a good businessman, which I'm not, but even if I was, who gave me the brain? Right? I make some good investments. Who organized things that the cocoa bean futures that I invested in were not destroyed by a hurricane in South America? Right? But money lost and gained, it's like that very often. So it's an awareness that there is a God. What is Judaism's technique for being aware that there is a God? Many ways. Prayer, as we just said, blessings. The awareness that there is a God in the world. And this is key and central. Without the awareness that there is a God, we would say life is just not... Without these two key awarenesses, that I have a soul and that there is a God, life is not worth living. It's not life. It's not life. Life has to be with the awareness that there is that I am not just physical. I mean, the physical life, when you look at it, is very pathetic. We're talking about 75, maximum 120 years. It's a short time in the total. 15.3 billion years, 75 years, is a very, very small slice of the pie. Very small. And during that time, how much time are we sleeping? Depends how many seminars you attend. But again, let's say a lot of that time is sleeping. A lot of that time is engaged in childhood. Not very productive, at least not immediately productive. Right? There's a lot of time which is spent flossing and brushing teeth. Very important. But elevation? I don't know. Right? So where are we? What's the human being? That's it. That's it. Right? And so a life without Judaism, without teaching me that there is a soul and that there is a God, and those two are intrinsically connected, that's a life without spirituality. And indeed, we say that's a life which is tragic. The Talmud says a very, very shocking statement. It says, Tzadikim afilu b'motam nikru chayim. A righteous person, even when they're dead, they're called alive. And it says, an evil person, even when they're alive, they're called dead. What does it mean? It means the following. What is life? Life is movement. Life is movement. Movement, progress. Right? For instance, in Hebrew, the word for a spring which bubbles forth is called mayim chayim, which means living water. Now, the water's not living. Water's not living. Right? We have living water in New Jersey, but it's living with all types of bacteria and microorganisms that you don't want to hear about, right? But the word, when we say in Hebrew living water, what it means is water that continuously gives forth. Continuously gives forth. Progress. Movement. The human being is only really alive when we are making progress, not stagnation. Biologically, we say a similar idea. A system, a biological system which is in total equilibrium, what's the other word for that? Dead. Dead. But biological systems, are never, total equilibrium means ain't nothing doing there, right? That's it. Yeah. Nothing. Right? So an evil person, one who has divorced themselves from the soul, divorced themselves from God, did not take either into account, is really like a zombie. They're going through life without the essence of life, without that progress. A righteous person, even when that righteous person's dead, their soul is still moving. Their soul's still making progress. And indeed, the process of Judaism is, by the way, not a moment, but it's a lifelong process. I was with another great Jew in Israel, my Rebbe, Reb Moshe Shapiro, the week before. And I was with a fellow who asked Rabbi Shapiro, he says, Rabbi, at what point in your life did you arrive at a certainty of God's existence? That's what he asked Rabbi Shapiro. And Reb Moshe Shapiro responded, he said, there was no particular point. He says, I'm continuously working on that. It's a progress. He says, what I thought yesterday was certainty, I see today was not. He says, it's not really, you're not fulfilling your obligation unless every day I'm working on it. Every day there's a little bit of a different awareness. Every day there's some degree of progress. Every day there's something, an opportunity of opening of worlds. So it is our duty, he said, that the vada'ut, that the word he used in Hebrew, vada'ut, which means certainty, is a certainty, the different levels of certainty. I am certain that Hong Kong exists. I'm much more certain that I exist than Hong Kong exists, right? I mean, so I may be certain that God exists on the level of I know Hong Kong exists. But I've got to get to the level where I'm so certain that it's the same as I know that I exist. So that's a lifelong, right? It's a progress. That is also about spirituality. In Judaism, spirituality is growth, progress, working on oneself. Getting further. Awareness of self, soul, and awareness of God. So by the way, this also is part of the commandments. One of the purposes of many of the Torah laws of the commandments is to reveal godliness in the world. When I do things in this world, which are not just for purely utilitarian purposes, there's an indication that there is a God. People's pursuit of art, people's pursuit of philosophy, people's pursuit even of science, to me, is an indication that there's a soul. That there's a God. For survival, human beings do not need... I mean, for instance, Stephen Hawking, in his book, Brief History of Time, points out, he says, it's difficult for him to understand why evolution would endow the human being with the capacity to search into quantum physics. Is it necessary for survival? To know whether light is waves or particles? Right? To know whether the cause can come after the effect, according to Richard Friedman? Right? Is that necessary? He says, on the contrary, one could argue that quantum physics has led to the nuclear devices, which is actually contrary to survival. Right? The instinct of the human being to search, the instinct of the human being to look for more than just the next cheeseburger, that is something which is, because of the soul, because there's a God. It's that desire. It's the desire for the transcendental, to go beyond the fit we're not content with. We're never content with that. We're not content with that. That lack of contentedness is a good thing, because it means that we are searching for God means we are searching for our own souls, means we're searching for identity. And Judaism has many commandments which are designed to do this. So the revelation of God is a very important aspect of this. So let me just illustrate here. If I engage in an action which is purely selfish, utilitarian motives, that's to a certain degree a concealment of the divine. If I engage in an altruistic act of kindness, that is a revelation of the divine. So, for example, that man that I spoke about who stayed behind in the World Trade Center to offer comfort to another human being, knowing that he would die against his most basic survival instinct, that is a revelation that there is a God. It's a revelation that there's godliness within that human being. It's a revelation that there is a soul. It's a revelation of B'tzelem Elokim Barat Adam. Human was created in the image of God. It is our obligation to act in such a way that every action we do can either be a concealment of the divine presence or can be a revelation of the divine presence. That's where we balance. R' Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, great Jewish Italian Kabbalist from the 16th century, 17th century, he writes that everyone is balanced between revelation and concealment. That's where we are. That's our job. I remember I once told, I'm sure I've told this story here before, but I was once in University of California in Santa Barbara. I don't know if anyone's been there. It is a university with its own surfing beach. It's the ultimate. I mean, I cannot imagine a better place. I mean, it's got a lagoon. It's got palm trees. Perfect climate. It's unbelievable. I cannot imagine anyone ever graduating from there. It could be they don't. You know, it's America. Who knows? Right, so, but anyway, I was there giving a class, and I'm schmoozing with the students in Hillel House. And one of the students says to me, I'm asking him, what's your major? You know, America, United States has got fascinating majors, things that you can do in college, like that in most civilized countries you cannot do. Like, it's like, you know, things like at Brown University, I once taught a seminar there. They had a course, Empowerment of Women with Eating Disorders through Native American Song, Dance, and Fires. This is a higher education, right? If you want to know where your money is going when you pay for your child's college tuition, right, that's where some of it goes. Right. Anyway, so I'm at this university, you know, Santa Barbara, University of California, and I ask one of the guys, what are you majoring in? And he says, like, English they don't study, like something between religion and philosophy. I said, could you be more specific? He said, sure. And I said, go ahead. He says, oh, yeah. He says, I'm majoring in revelation. Revelation studies. In his case, no doubt chemically induced. But revelation studies. What is revelation studies? So I thought to myself, I went to a Hasidic high school. And they always used to teach us, the Baal Shem Tov used to say, founder of the Hasidic movement, 1701, Podolia, used to always say that anything that happens to you, anything that you experience, happen so that you can learn from it. Otherwise, why were you there? Now, obviously, you have free will, but there's an interaction between my free will and what happens around me. I'm not in control of what happens around me. I see something, it's for me to learn from. The Baal Shem Tov said this is an absolute truth, he said it as. Every single thing you see, learn from it. At the time he said this, he was walking with some students, and they're actually walking, and there was a river which had been frozen over. And there was a group of Cossacks cutting a large crucifix into the ice. So one of the students says to him, no, everything that happens we have to learn from. What do we learn from that? Baal Shem Tov says, the Torah is compared to water. If you let water and the Torah freeze into an intellectual exercise without the soul and the heart being involved, you can even carve a cross into it. That's what's happening there, right? So he told them. So I'm thinking to myself, what would the Baal Shem Tov learn from this guy in Santa Barbara? What would he learn from him? And I answered, it's very simple. It's actually explicit in the Tikkuni Zohar 73a, which is that every single person is supposed to be majoring in revelation. What does that mean? That my major in life is supposed to be acting in such a way that when someone looks at me or my actions or hears me speak, you know what they say? They say, there, image of God. God created man in his image. I could act in such a way that a person says, Darwin looks very interesting. looks very, right? Look at this guy, right? Yeah, you look at this guy, you say something like, you know, the Tyson, Mike Tyson, Allah, right? That type of guy, right? You look at someone, you don't say immediately, man was created in the image of God. You don't say that, right? There are many people who act in such a way, vicious, violent, selfish, egotistical, whatever. Concealment, darkness. Human beings are supposed to reveal the light of God, reveal godliness in the world, which is what a lot of the, in fact, according to the Zohar, all the mitzvahs, all the commandments, all the laws of Torah are really about that. So we just finished the festival of Sukkot. Festival of Sukkot is a strange festival, isn't it? We sit out, you know, I had this guy I'm studying with knows nothing about Judaism. So he was at someone's house for Purim once. That was one of his experiences. Is that one? Yeah, and then so I said to him, I said, you know, we got this, I said, we have a festival coming up where we actually sleep out in the backyard. He says, oh, Purim. I said, actually, correct, but for different reasons. Purim, we also live in the backyard very often, but it's totally different reasons. So I said, no, Sukkot. But Sukkot is a very strange thing. And what do you do on Sukkot, right? It is totally non-utilitarian. You know what I mean? You build a very strange-looking booth. You a lousy roof. In fact, it has to be a lousy roof. If the roof would get a certificate of occupancy, it would be invalid as a sukkah, right? So if the local council approves you as a sukkah, you've got a problem. Okay, so you're non-utilitarian. You then take fragrant lemon, this like lemon on steroids that you pay $100 for, called an etrog, right? Don't smell it. Don't eat it. Just hold it. Palm fronds, which you might want to use as shade. Myrtle branch, which smells wonderful. Right? You know, and what do you do with all your things? Don't eat it. Don't smell it. Don't burn it. Don't use it as shelter. Do this. Very strange. The answer is, Judaism is not utilitarian. It's not. It's not its purpose. Right? Granted, you need a utilitarian society so that life will not be, as that great philosopher said, nasty, brutish, and short. Right. However, but aside from that, Judaism is far beyond that. We're not just here in order to have a world that will not degenerate into California. Right. We are here to create a world, right, which will to build a world in which godliness is obvious and revealed and clear. Right? That's the second component of Jewish spirituality. The third component is the imitation of God. That is to say, acting like Hashem, acting like God. That's what we're supposed to do. And the fact the Bible starts, the Talmud points this out, the Bible starts with God clothing the naked. It starts with God making a date, the Shidduch, Adam and Eve. It ends with God burying Moses to teach us, just as he is merciful, you have to be merciful. Just as he is kind, you have to be kind. Just as he clothes the naked, so do you have to do so. Just as he... Actually, there's a story. There was a Hasidic Rebbe, the Gera Rebbe, previous Gera Rebbe. Now, the Gera Hasidic headquarters in Jerusalem is right across the road from the largest army base in Jerusalem called Schneller. It's a great little juxtaposition, right, of two worlds. You know, you've got the Gera Hasidic headquarters, and you've got Jerusalem Army Command, Schneller. So now, the Gera Rebbe used to give fruit out to people. Blessing, you know, give them fruit, oranges, right? So he's walking with his gabbai, his secretary. They're walking along. And a soldier, it's summer, a soldier from Schneller is jogging towards them, wearing only very brief shorts. Right? And, you know, the secretary like looks at the Rebbe and says, look at this. So the Rebbe says, stop him. Give him an orange. Soldier's like, schmitzing. He stops. The Ger Rebbe says, gives him an orange. He says, oh, toda Rebbe? Yeah, orange, great. Right? And he jogs on. So the secretary asked the Rebbe, what's going on? You give the guy an orange. Look at the way he's dressed. He says, exactly. Adam and Eve ate a fruit. They realized they were naked. Maybe it'll help him too. So, indeed, God clothes the naked. God sustains even those who disagree with him. Right? As Ramosha Cordovero points out, every person that does a sin is doing a sin as he is being sustained by God. God's giving him the strength, the existence, and the power to rebel against God. Sustaining him. It's a major lesson for us, especially with my parenting lecture. That will be a major issue, right? Right? That he sustains. He doesn't cut off just because you don't agree with me, you're doing something opposite me, against me. No. God still gives. Right? So we learn we have to imitate God. In fact, there's a very beautiful statement of Chaim Soloveitchik, who is a very great sage, probably have heard of the Soloveitchik family. Ruchaim Soloveitchik from Brisk in Lithuania, He was once said, following statement, he said it in Yiddish, and my Yiddish is not very good. It went something like this. Yenem's Gashmius is mine Ruchnius, which means the other person's physical needs are my spiritual needs. What did he mean by that? He meant very simply. He meant that the fact that I want to connect to God and be in touch with my own soul is not going to work if I do that by isolating myself on a mountaintop or isolating myself anywhere, for that matter, even if it's a yeshiva or a shul, and not having contact with other people and not having contact with society. Because what it means is I'm missing out on a major part of it. Right? God created a world. It means God is not an isolationist. He created in order to give, in order to have contact, in order to interact. So we have to be concerned with other people. If we are isolated, and hence I'm in contact, like perhaps, and I don't mean to criticize meditation as a whole, but there are forms of meditation where what's the focus in meditation? Moi. What am I thinking about? Judaism, how are you supposed to pray? By yourself or with a group? You're supposed to pray with a group. Why? When I'm with a group, I'm not only thinking of myself, I'm thinking of others as well. The Rabbi Yehuda Halevi gives an example. He says, if the person who drives a wagon, he says, please don't let it rain. He might say that if he's by himself. But if he's standing in a shul and around him are a bunch of farmers, and he says, how can I pray to God that it shouldn't rain? I mean, I can't look at myself as isolated. I am part of this. I'm part of a group. I've got a responsibility for others. Very interesting. Chasam Sofer points out that there was in last week's parsha, we are told in Genesis, we are told that there was a man by the name of Chanoch. In English, it's called Enoch. Right? How they got Enoch from Chanoch, I don't know. But okay. Chanoch, it says, was... It doesn't say he died. It says, Ve'einenu kilakach oto elokim. He no longer existed because God took him. What does that mean? Kabbalists say he was so elevated in terms of his body was like so transparent to spirituality, to God, that he ceased to exist as a physical being. That's how holy he was. Ceased to exist as a physical being. What's interesting is that despite that, the person who got the title, my beloved, God gave him the title, my beloved, was not Chanoch. It was Abraham. God calls Abraham, Abraham, my beloved. Avraham Ohavi, Abraham, my beloved. Chanoch, as great as he was, never gets the title Chanoch, my beloved. Why not? Why not? Surely Chanoch had a closer connection to God, had a closer connection to his own soul. Abraham died a normal death. Chanoch didn't even die a normal death. He just became so elevated he ceased to exist in the spirit, in the physical plane. What's the answer? The answer is very interesting. Rav Moshe Sofer of Pressburg says, because Chanoch achieved this by isolation from everyone else. Of course, he said, he isolated himself, he focused only on himself, he achieved tremendous, tremendous elevation of spirit, he tremendous, tremendous focus and clarity at the expense of everyone else. Abraham, on the other hand, what did Abraham do? He invited people into his house. He made them food. He ran around, right, advertisements for guests, he ran around, he gave lectures, he did this, he did that, he was involved with humanity. It meant that that perhaps you looked at him and maybe spiritually a little less refined than Chanoch, but he was God's beloved, because he was doing stuff for other people as well. So a major component, and this we cannot miss, Judaism, heavily focused on the fact that I've got to be, my own spirituality can only be accessed if I imitate God. And imitation of God is, how do we know God? He's a giver. What do I have to do? I have to be a giver. I have to be involved with others. Cannot lock myself away. Celibacy, isolation, it's out. In Jewish tradition, you have to be involved in the world, involved with others, giving to others. That is the path to spirituality. So these are the three major components. Getting in touch, awareness of the spiritual side of the self, the soul, as we saw some of the techniques. Getting in touch with God and his being aware of God. And awareness of others and contact with others. This, of course, is, not of course, but this is hinted at, well, this is a real explanation of the Mishnah, a very famous Mishnah in the first chapter of Ethics of the Fathers. The Mishnah says the world stands upon three things. Torah, study of Torah, Avodah, service of God, Gemilut Chasadim, kindness to others. The Maharal explains in his book Derech HaChaim, his commentary on Ethics of the Fathers, Maharal explains what are these three things. He says they are the three things which I've been talking about. No, he doesn't say, he doesn't quote me, but I'm quoting him. But he says they are, first of all, Torah. The study of Torah is the study really of what's going on inside the soul, what the self is. The Jewish self is found in the Torah. Kud Shebrichu Yisrael Ve'oreisa Chad Hu. God, the Jewish people, and the Torah are one. Knowledge of the Torah is knowledge of the soul. It's a commandment that's between me and myself. Myself and I. Torah, relationship to the self and to my soul. Avodah, relationship to God. It literally means service or prayer to God, relationship to God. And the third is Gemilut Chasadim, which means kindness to others, which is the relationship with the other. Those are the Maharal says, these are the three legs, the tripod of our existence. Torah, relationship to self and the soul. Avodah, relationship to God. Gemilus Chasadim, relationship to other people. And any one of these is missing, then the person is missing a major part of their reason for existence, major part of their whole purpose in the world. Right? And that's what we have to try to regain. Unfortunately, in the world today, there are a few problems with each of these. We all know there is a tremendous pursuit of the physical, and it's become a culture. I mean, the culture of the body. It's gone beyond mere health. It's gone to the point of the sculpted body. Right, I have to have the six-pack abs, anorexia, eating disorders. I mean, I used to go to a gym in Jerusalem. There were these people there who, there were mirrors in the gym. I never saw them walk by without stopping and admiring the view. I mean, every time they walk by the mirror, you know, a little flex here and there. I mean, what? That's it? Right, how can such a... I mean, it's not... I can't understand health. Health is wonderful. Right, exercise is wonderful, but it became just the, you know, Western culture is such a focus on the external. It's incredible the degree of focus on that, and of course the pursuit of a livelihood which is difficult and which consumes so much of our time, so much of our energy, so much of our emotional power. And obviously also there is a tremendous focus on the self, on me, on what I deserve, on rights, on what can I get, what am I owed, what can I get out of you, the government, etc., etc. Tremendous focus on the self. Makes it very difficult. We're really Judaism, as usual, is a counterculture movement. Always has been. I would be worried if Judaism was mainstream. We're always, God already predicted that we'll always be the smallest of nations. Lo merubchem mikol ha'amim. Not from your bulk, from your population, God says, do I love you, but because you are the smallest. We are like a protest movement, always have been. So on the contrary, we should not be discouraged by this, we should be encouraged, right? Because, you know, generally, that's the way it's been through history. We have been in the minority, we've been struggling. So this is part of our struggle. Part of our struggle is that we, to struggle against the focus on self, just for the self, the focus on the body as opposed to the soul, and the focus on the words of Rav Nachman Bulman, Alav HaShalom, who always used to say that, he says, Western culture is rosy-cheeked from consumption of the soul, and the ignoring of God in our lives, the ignoring of God in society. This is true whether a person is putting on tefillin and eating kosher. People can sometimes do this without thinking of God once. Amazing, but it's true. Right? Possible. Right? Person can go through their entire day, right, doing lots and lots of rituals and stuff and not thinking of God. A person can, on the other hand, also go through an entire day of helping other people, not once thinking of God. They can sometimes help other people, not thinking of other people, but only of the self. A person can go through a day just indulging in the self, not thinking about... Each one is possible by itself, but it's not good enough. It has to be all three together, really, to lead a full Jewish life. And really, that's what we're out to do. And that's a little bit of an opening into what Judaism is about, I think, and how Judaism can lead us to spirituality. We have to focus on these commandments, on these mitzvahs, as the opportunities and the ability to lead us to this concept of spirituality. Okay, I am going to end the speech now, but I am going to, I'll take questions, heckling, alternate speeches. Actually, forget the alternate speeches, but questions and heckling are fine. And feel free to ask anything, preferably on the subject of Judaism, but I'll be happy to take questions for a few minutes. Thank you very much for coming. Oh, what's up? Just an announcement before we start questions.
Yeah, just before we get into questions, in case anybody does walk out, lunch for those who have registered will be available in 15 minutes next door in chat. And then at 1 o'clock there will be classes available here with Is Religious Truth Absolute with Dr. Berger and Rabbi Broyd, or Women's Physical and Spiritual Health with Susan Schneider and Dr. Zimmerman. Those will begin at 1 o'clock following lunch. I was asked just to remind everyone to please make sure to fill in your forms reviewing how the classes and programs have been so far, and to do so throughout the day. At this time, we'll take questions for about the next 5 minutes.
Yes.
I'm just curious to know, are you a quotation mark, big quotation mark, BT or FFB?
The question, I'll just translate some of the terminology. BT means a Baal Tshuva, generally means someone who was not brought up observant and became observant. And then you've got FFB, from birth. There are other terms also, like FFT, from Tuesday. There is GMG, which means Gurnish McGurnish. There are many, many different terms, technical terms, in the in era psychology of Judaism. Neither, really. I'll tell you what, my family was always very traditional.
A, B, and C, right?
my family was always very traditional. In Australia, I don't know if it's like that in Canada, but in Australia you can have people who are very traditional, go to an Orthodox synagogue, but in practice really do not keep Jewish law. It was very, very common. How religious you were was how far away from the shul you parked your car on Shabbos. Right? So, you know, if you were two blocks away, you know, if you're like in the parking lot, okay, it's average. Right? So, you know, we're type like that. But at about age 13, I became halakhically observant. Both my sister and I was about 13, 14, and then I transferred into a yeshiva high school at that point, with the blessing and encouragement of my parents, I should say. Of course, there was a student at Ponovich, probably one of the top yeshivas in the world, very advanced Talmudic college, who went to Rav Shach, the Rosh Yeshiva, head of the yeshiva, and Rav Shach asked him, he says, "Are you a Baal Tshuva?" And the guy said, "No." And Rav Shach said, "Why not?" Ultimately, everyone has to be a Baal Tshuva, right? Everyone's got to make progress. You're not allowed to stay where you were, right? You've got to keep going, and that means Baal Tshuva. Yes, any other questions? The mic. Okay.